Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Our focus today is on family caregiving, how to be as effective as you can be in a pretty complicated situation, how to avoid the emotional burnout that can accompany caregiving responsibilities, and where to find the help that you need. And we're talking about this today because there are more resources than you may be aware of. So as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you. Have you found yourself stepping in to provide care to a loved one who is aging or dealing with an illness? What's the single most challenging thing about your experience? And as you think about that, think about what would help. What kind of resources could you really use to help solve or help alleviate that most challenging thing about caregiving? So this morning, I'm looking for your experience as a caregiver. I'm asking you what the single most challenging part of doing that kind of work was. And what would help? What would really alleviate some of the isolation, some of the responsibility, some of the just not knowing which way to turn for good support or advice? Here's the phone number on that, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Donna Thompson is with us. She's co-author of the new book, The Unexpected Journey of Caring, The Transformation from Loved One to Caregiver. She is herself a caregiver. Donna, welcome. It's good to have you with us from Quebec, Canada this morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here.
Kathy Good is with us, director of the Family Caregiver Center of Mercy in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. They're a hub for giving caregiver support, and she joins us from Cedar Rapids. And Kathy, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
Donna, the title of your book really zeroes in on something that I wanted to talk about at the beginning of the conversation, and that is how emotionally unusual it often is to step in as the role of the caregiver, whether you're doing this for a parent, someone else in your family, or a partner. Dig in a little bit on that, would you?
Yeah, sure. It's a role that comes at us. It's not a role that we would ever choose. And it's not a role that we talk about much at all, because it's not a role that we aspire to. There are no graduation ceremonies, there's no celebrations about being a caregiver. It's a role that's extremely private and very, very difficult to describe. So I think one of the things that I've talked about a lot in our book with Dr. Zachary White, who is a professor of caregiver communications at Queen's University in Charlotte. Zachary and I talk a lot about the language of caring and the fact that there is a great poverty of language to describe how we feel about this role, because it's often very conflicted.
Mm-hmm.
It's two opposites at the same time. It's hope and despair. It's joy and burden. It's all these opposites mixed up in a very new, and it's a new role and one that we have no experience with previously. So it's really, I think, a huge challenge, and all of this conspires to make people feel very alone,
yeah.
I think.
You know, Kathy, I think as Donna talks about the conflict of this, because you've got elements of privacy and dignity and love and deterioration, I really understand it when she says we struggle to try to describe this, but we do need to describe it, right?
Yes, and Pauline Boss, who is in your area in Minneapolis, talks about this as kind of like ambiguous loss. And she talks about that when you are a caregiver, you're caring for somebody who is still there, but not there in the same way that they have been.
Right.
And so it's important emotionally to grieve the losses as they occur for you as a caregiver, but to remember at the same time what you still have and what the person still has also, and acknowledge that. So that's one of the ways that we talk with caregivers here at our center about how to deal with that, some of the emotional aspects of the caregiving process.
Samantha says on Twitter, my mom and I were caregivers to my grandfather, dementia and nursing home, and then my grandmother, cancer a year later. Watching them slowly deteriorate was the absolute worst, and it puts tension on your other relationships as you try to emotionally cope. I'm going to come back to that. I want to take a call here from Bridget in St. Cloud. Hi, Bridget. What was your experience with this? Hi, Bridget. Are you there? Hi. Talk to us a bit about your experience with that.
Yeah, sure. So I was 18 when my mom was diagnosed with ALS, and she was 45. And for 2 years, I was her primary caregiver, and we made sure that we were able to stay home and do everything at home. So I also tried to balance college, caregiving, and regular other life. And I wasn't emotionally prepared for what a challenge that would be for me.
I don't know how you could have been, Bridget, at 19 or 20 years old. Oh.
Yeah, I'm not quite, you know, your brain isn't even developed all the way by then. So looking back, I do have some regrets, but I feel like the support with how to handle loss and grief would have been pretty helpful for me.
So being connected, Bridget, somehow to a community of other caregivers, you think that would have made a difference?
Yeah, also like one-on-one counseling and support of you know, what a unique situation that caregivers are in, every single one of them, whether they are 19 or 40 or 50, 60, you know.
Yeah, it's a good, Bridget, I'm going to take that back to Kathy, who has founded this or is directing this Caregiver Center for Resources. So, Kathy, how do you handle this when you have caregivers who are in very different stages of their lives? Bridget was really young when she was doing this.
Absolutely, and she talks about one-on-one counseling, and one of the things that we do here at the center is to provide a one-on-one experience where she would come in, where Bridget would come in, and we would sit down and talk with her about what her needs are. We hopefully would provide emotional support because we are volunteer-led and run. 99% of our volunteers have been or are currently caregivers. We say we talk caregivers. Caregiver here, so we think we can relate to a person like Bridget.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would help her figure out, based upon the needs that she identified, how we could connect her with resources in the community. They could be emotional counseling, or it could be kind of some non-medical in-home care providers, respite for her.
Because she said she was trying to
identify the needs.
Yeah, she said she was still trying to live her own life, right? Go to college and live the life that you do at 19 or 20. Donna, a question about, do you find that people who are head down in this caregiving situation are often unaware of how, of just what they're undertaking, of what they're balancing? Does it often take somebody from the outside to say, I want to identify for you all the balls that you're trying to juggle here?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I hear Kathy saying is that it's so important in speaking and coaching and helping caregivers navigate in those conversations, it's about saying, okay, your life is like a pie chart, and piece of that pie is maybe your work, your school, your family. But looking at it right now, caregiving has squeezed out a lot of the other parts of your life.
Right.
And where is the tipping point where you have to say, okay, let's look at my day and let's look at what I'm actually doing on a daily basis. Name three things that you would like, in a perfect world, someone else to do for you.
Mm-hmm.
And let's think about who's in the community, who you know, and as you said, you know, what are those hidden resources in the community that we can link with your needs? So it's a two-part process of needs identification and then matching up resources in the community and in your personal network, and then in that very rich community of caregivers, which is full of information, knowledge, and wisdom, just like Kathy said.
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, about caregiving. A lot of us are being called on to do this for a spouse, a partner, a loved one, a parent. There are a lot of Americans who are in what they call the sandwich generation, right? Providing care for aging parents or an aging relative, and then still, of course, maintaining your family life and your career. If you find yourself in that situation now, stepping in to provide care to a loved one, what are you encountering as the most challenging parts of doing that kind of work and providing that kind of support? And what would help most? I mean, I think as we hear about more and more of the resources that are available to you, it would be valuable to hear about what you needed or need. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at CarrieNPR, Donna Thompson with us, the author, co-author of The Unexpected Journey of Caring, and Kathy Good with us, director of the Family Caregiver Center of Mercy in Cedar Rapids. Donna, I have to come back here to what Samantha was saying about it putting tension on your other relationships as you try to emotionally cope. It is understandable that all of your attention and mind space, right, is going to the immediate needs of the person that you're caregiving. But you have a life and important relationships. What can we say about balancing that?
Well, it is a very tricky balance. And I think what makes it harder sometimes is the fact that it's very difficult for other people to understand how we are experiencing caregiving, because how we experience caregiving has a lot to do with maybe your previous experiences of caregiving, and especially your pre-existing relationship with the person you're looking after. So lots of people look after their parents, and you know, the pre-existing relationship was maybe not so perfect. And so caregiving is layering on another very complex reality. And trying to explain that to other people in the family or coworkers is very difficult. So sometimes what we end up doing is putting on one of three masks in order to make it easier for that other person to be comfortable in the conversation.
I see.
We do this as a kind of, you know, either the fighter mask, oh, we're really battling this disease, or the I'm fine mask, I'm perfectly fine, nothing the matter with me, or the saint mask, which often, and then people can say, oh, I could never do what you do. So let's just talk about something else.
Yeah. Kathy, a call for you here from Jean in Minneapolis. Hi, Jean. What's your experience with this?
I'm taking care of my 90-year-old mother. I'm near 70 now.
Mm-hmm.
And mom has dementia, but one of the features of that disease is an inability to recognize the disease itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the role of managing her finances, managing the transition from driving to no car, managing the transition from independent living to assisted living.
Mm-hmm.
And that's putting an enormous strain on my relationship with my mother, because it puts me in the position of, from her perspective, being the meddler, the boss, the manager, and she's losing independence and dignity and integrity in the process, and is pushing back.
Jean, you said dementia, right?
Yes.
And short-term memory. Kathy, I think we're going to hear from a number of people this morning who are in caregiving situations for people with dementia. Tell me how the Family Caregiver Center that you run steps in on those situations.
Well, we would clearly work with the caregiver to say that the best way to deal with some of those difficult situations, like it's just been described, is to acknowledge the feelings that the person is having. So you might say, I'm so sorry that the conversations we're having or the situation that you're in is making you feel upset, not trusting. This is really hard. This is really hard for both of us. And so starting with the feelings first, no guarantees here that that will make it easy, but it might make it easier, because I think that the person living with dementia, while their cognitive abilities may be decreasing, their sense of feelings increases. So you always want to start there and acknowledge the feelings, and probably get your own feelings in check before you deal with them, to see that you want to be as kind as you can be, but you can't trust the judgment any longer of the person living with dementia, because if you could, you wouldn't be in that situation. So, but you also want to involve them as much as you can. So if you can sit with them to do the bills, if you can sit with them to make the appointments, the more involvement that you can have, that works, the better. And then clearly dealing with the feelings.
Wow. Steve called to say, I've been my mom's caregiver for several years now. She's 98. Before that, I was my dad's caregiver. Now that it's just me and my mom, I have three siblings, but I'm down to asking for just three personal days to see friends per year. But I don't get that. My life has shrunk down tremendously. On Twitter, a listener says, working to maintain his dignity when something is misplaced over and over, I don't want him to be afraid that he's losing his mind. When he trips over nothing, I don't want him to think he's losing his abilities. These may be happening, but it's not necessary to embarrass him. Kathy, I'm going to come back to you. As predicted, many people who are caregiving in a dementia situation, I heard you say involve the person you're caring for as much as you possibly can. You know, I'll bet the tendency or the instinct is to be like, I'm just going to be efficient and get this done. And in the end, that will be the best for the person that I'm giving care to and the best for me. Why is involving the person so essential?
Well, because I think in our culture, typically in a traditional way, we have tended to dismiss people who are living with dementia as already being gone. And so then it doesn't occur to us that we should look for ways to involve them. But the person living with dementia is really still there. But Dr. Alan Power talks about it as a shift in the way that they experience the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start looking at the fact that the person is still there, but they have a shift in the way that they experience the world, then you try to figure out, because it promotes their autonomy, it meets their needs for autonomy, it recognizes their identity as a person. So that's why you want to involve them and figure out, like, what can you do with them? My husband lived with dementia, and I wish I would have understood Dr. Power's message better, because when he got to the point where he wasn't able to feed himself, I just started feeding him. And I wish I would have known to maybe help him feed himself, maybe guided his hand so that he could have had more autonomy, more independence longer. And it promotes their autonomy. It recognizes their identity. It provides them some security in that they can see that there are still some things that they are capable of doing, even with assistance.
Donna, could you weigh in on that too?
Yeah, I'm just listening so carefully, and my heart is full listening to you describe how you experienced this loss with your husband, Kathy. And I think that, yes, you know, sometimes my mother died August 16th, 2018 at the age of 96 with after experience dementia as well. And I think the thing is that we almost need to reintroduce ourselves. The relationship and that shift that has occurred in the person, we need to discover and with intention, what is left? What is the person capable of doing on their own? And I'm really struck by the comment that came in that, you know, we are the brokers, we are the translators of the people we love to the world, and protecting their dignity is exhausting because we need to kind of joke about it or sweep it under the floor or say it's okay when a new loss is encountered. And that can be very painful, and you're trying constantly to protect the feelings and the dignity of the person you love.
Donna, that's such a good way to describe it, a translator. I saw my mother go through this with her second husband, and I think the reaction to that may be to withdraw, right, more and more into isolation, because that is a tough balancing act.
It really is. Even having a walk around the block where the neighbors had known the, you know, the person you love for years, and this is a, you know, is a different person. A shift has occurred, and you need to reintroduce. And this is all about loss. So it's very difficult.
Call here from Gretchen in Lino Lakes. Hi, Gretchen. I'm glad you waited.
Hi.
Thanks
for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a wonderful conversation. My mom passed away from Lewy body dementia in May.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, well, you guys are making such wonderful points, but I think as I look back, the hardest thing for me, or the thing that changed the most, is the support from my mom's extended family. She was part of a big family, and some of them live out of town. And so I think, you know, my dad and I were doing it alone, and I think what we needed the most was just support, as in, you know, encouragement and, you know, maybe breaks and things like that. And
right.
I think what we got instead was a whole lot of advice.
I see.
And, yeah. Which I get it. You know, I get that they thought they were being helpful. And it was hard on everybody.
Yeah, so more of, if you have you thought of doing this, or could you do that instead of stepping in to say, I can be there for half a day while you go do some other things, yeah?
Yeah, and we did, there was one in particular that would come in, you know, once a week. But it really changed the family dynamics, and it felt like more of a loss, because I felt like, you know, we didn't really get the support that we necessarily needed.
Yeah. Kathy, I've heard that from some friends who have been in this situation, that some of the, I don't know, maybe true colors isn't a fair enough way to say it, but boy, the relationships within the family really change in a situation like this. Yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely. And there are a couple of thoughts here that I have in my head. And one of them is that I think that we all grieve differently. And I think that there still is a stigma about dementia. And I think that sometimes the way that we deal with our grief is just to try and remove ourselves because we're scared that, I don't know whether we're scared that we'll catch it, it'll happen to us, or but we're just totally unprepared as a culture to know exactly what to do in those situations. And so I think that more and more people are understanding dementia and the various types of dementia. And so education of the public is really important, which I think will help all families in general. But also, sometimes I think we don't have any control over what happens with our relatives and what they choose to do and not do, or what they choose to say and not say. And so sometimes I think you have to just be ready to acknowledge that their intent is positive, but kind of to let go of the things that they say because they're not helpful, and to be discerning about and knowing that it's okay.
That sounds pretty saint-like too, Kathy. I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty hard.
I know. Yeah. Kathy Good with us from the Family Caregivers Center of Mercy in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where they have a whole center dedicated to supporting caregivers themselves. Donna Thompson with us, co-author of the new book, The Unexpected Journey of Caring. Sarah on Twitter today saying, my sister and I are caring for our 74-year-old mom who has dementia. I appreciate that our mom created a health care directive and set up a POA prior to her illness. This helps guide our decisions. I'm grateful to have a sibling to share in the responsibility of taking care of our mom. We'll get a look at the latest news. When we come back, one of the things that Kathy's center is doing in Iowa is providing some caregiving coaching and financial advice. I think that's an important element of this. How do you manage this if you're taking time off from work, if you're finding that you're needing to spend additional money on providing this care? We'll talk about that. Is that something that has figured into your own experience? 651-227-6000. If you're getting a busy signal, try us back. 800-242-2828. Always Twitter to get in on the conversation, at Carrie NPR. To Phil Picardi now, and Phil, what's your lead story? Back to our conversation about what the caregivers need, right? So often the focus on the people that we're caregiving to, and this is a discussion about caregivers themselves. I just got a tweet from Liz who says, I'm an only child with two toddlers. My mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and my stepdad intends to care for her alone. I wish your doctors would push for better plans for the future instead of just treating the symptoms. I feel alone in seeing the gravity of this without a good plan. Donna, will you speak to, I actually saw my mother go through this too, this idea that I can handle this as the person closest to the person in need. I am the best person to do this caregiving. What do those conversations with support groups and with yourself sound like?
Mm-hmm. It's very difficult because I think it's a natural inclination for, say, a married couple, for the spouse to say, we will do this together.
Right.
And I think the danger there, though, is that you don't know where the disease is going to go. And I think that, what we don't understand, I think, is that as a disease progresses, frailty that's related to aging progresses, that caregiving is actually done better as a team.
Hmm.
And this is very opposite to what we believe as a culture, that we should look after our own, that independence is the number one value that we hold. And yet that is at odds with the way, that we used to do it. Historically speaking, we understand that it takes a village to raise a child, but it takes a village to look after our elderly and our ill, too. So I think helping people understand that there is a degree of unpredictability to the trajectory of the disease, and that it's okay to put up your hand for help. And when, under what circumstances is help going to be needed? And help people very gently scenario plan a little bit so that if and when this happens, if and when, you know, you feel like you need help, I'm going to be right here. Just tell me. And giving people that permission to ask for help, I think, is important.
Kathy, I don't want to miss the financial end of this. I note that your center is focused on the isolation part of this, the coaching part of this, but you're also giving some advice on the financial end of this. And I think this ends up being a burden for people that are in this, you know, for the long term. What are you communicating to people about what to be prepared for when it comes to the finances?
Well, we have several financial kinds of planning sessions that we offer here. We have partnered with the Extension Service with Iowa State University, and they have a Finances in Caregiving course that's a four-week course that takes caregivers through the whole process of what they need to think about.
Wow.
And it could be that in other parts of the country, the Extension Services connected with local universities might be offering that. I'm not sure it's very well known. I think it's one of those hidden resources, but that's very helpful. Transamerica has partnered with MIT, and they have a financial planning package called Financial Planning in the Shadows of Dementia that is particularly geared to families who are dealing, whose loved one has dementia. Just last night we had a session here, and so I think if you contact your Transamerica representative in your area, they can, if you're dealing with dementia, they can connect you with that resource and take you through it. And then we also have a question and answer session quarterly regarding Medicaid, because sometimes that is a resource, as well as veterans benefits. And so we have local people that come in quarterly to do questions and answers about resources that might be available to you and what the rules and the regs are that would qualify you for that.
Okay, good. To the phones to Joe in Minneapolis. Good morning, Joe. Really glad you waited. Thanks for that. It sounds like you've got some experience with this.
Well, I do. My wife has Alzheimer's. And the thing that I miss the most, basically, is sitting every day and talking about important things, not important things, just talking.
Right.
I miss that tremendously. And the other thing I want to point out is something that really surprised me. My wife's friends, on their own, no request from me, suddenly start showing up a couple times a week delivering food to our house.
Wonderful.
It actually has amazed me how helpful that has been.
Joe, so are you getting any, it sounds like you are in the primary role of caregiving for your wife right now?
Okay. I am, yes.
So have you connected with any of these support organizations that we're talking about to give you some relief and respite from this?
Well, I've done two things. I've gone to a caregiver support group that meets once a month, and that's been tremendously helpful.
Good.
And the other thing I've done is basically reach out to people. I've never been the type to reach out before, but I've reached out to friends and said, I need to talk. And
good.
It's been tremendously helpful.
How many years in are you on this?
She's had it for... diagnosed 8 years ago. She was a professor at the medical school, which is also another thing. She was absolutely the smartest person I ever knew.
A brilliant person.
Yes, it's hard to deal with the change.
I wonder, Kathy, as you listen to a bit of Joe's experience, if you have any more advice?
Well, Joe, I'm sorry for what you're experiencing, and I think it's very hard. My husband was a judge, and so you look at their abilities, and when you see them slowly slip away, it's really hard. I'm glad you're going to a support group. I don't know if that's one that's offered through the Alzheimer's Association, but they do have support groups. I'm sorry you're not here in Cedar Rapids because we have a male caregiver coffee, because what we know is that being a caregiver as a male is different than being a caregiver when you're a female.
Why is that?
Well, I think that probably women grow up in a more nurturing kind of role. They're taking care of the household and the kids, and I think while we've moved some from that and there's more gender equity, I think we still see that women are more prone to know how to multitask and take care of all those kinds of resources. I also think that emotionally, I think we allow women to express their feelings better than men do. And so I think there's just some kind of gender inequity in terms of when you're placed in the caregiving role. And so that's why we have developed this group that's been highly successful. And it is growing. It is led by a retired internist who is a caregiver, and another man who also has had past caregiving experience. And they facilitate this group. It meets twice a month, sometimes three times a month if there are five Tuesdays in a month. So we do see that there are some differences.
So maybe a place for Joe to seek out to see if there's something like that in the Twin Cities.
Yes, and there could be something at the Wilder Center.
Okay.
And maybe that's where you're already going to the support group. I don't know. But the Wilder Center comes the closest that we have been able to find here as being a community resource for caregivers.
A call here from Kelly in St. Paul. Hi, good morning, Kelly.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your story?
So this hit home in such a surprising, close to home in such a surprising way. When I was 19, I started dating my husband, and he had a 12-year-old brother with no parents, really. And we ended up caring for him well into his adulthood, probably till he was 25, 26.
Wow.
We provided him with his first Christmas, school clothing, and he started suffering from depression, and I had to take off work for all the times that he went into the psychiatric unit. And listening to your guys' conversation, I realized I was never viewed as a caregiver.
Right.
And I, even though I loved him and I gave him everything, no one seemed to understand the depths of this new role that I kind of just fell into. I didn't ask for.
At such a young age, too.
At such a young age.
Yeah.
And there were no resources. And I just wanted to thank you guys for this conversation, because even if you're not dealing with dementia or Alzheimer's, I think that this conversation is really important, because it literally wasn't until I heard this conversation that I thought, oh my goodness,
that was
what
you.
I was a caregiver.
Right. I'm really glad you caught the show and you had a chance to call it. I think somebody with a somewhat similar experience to Rachel in Minneapolis. Rachel, you were pretty young when you ended up being a caregiver. Is that right?
Yes.
What's your story?
So when I was 16, my mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And I am now 32, and she is still alive.
Wow.
She's actually in Houston right now receiving radiation. And I'm an only child, and she is not married. So I have been caregiving for my mom off and on as the cancer goes sort of in and out. And I've been doing that for 16 and a half years.
Wow.
So, yes, yes. So, and I never had any support services offered to me. Luckily, I had, you know, therapists and things, but I was never offered any support services. And now there's plenty of stuff for young children whose parents have cancer. They've worked hard to sort of fill that gap over the years, but there's still nothing for young adults, which people about 20 to 45, the millennial age group, and more and more and more millennials are caring for ill parents. There are more millennials living at home working as caregivers than ever before. It's a really staggering number. And so I've gone about trying to found an organization that will provide support services for young adults
Very good.
Who have a parent with cancer. And hopefully that will open up to a broader range of illnesses very soon.
What's the name of the organization that you've created?
Yeah, so it was founded this year, and it's called Love Labor Project.
Uh-huh.
And right now we're in an advocacy phase. And we're looking for more young adult caregivers who have a parent with cancer, whether they are still alive or not, but they're looking for support and community, people who've been through what they've been through. Because when you're young, your life isn't established. The things that you have to put on hold to care for a parent are unbelievable. The sacrifices you make. I know plenty of people who left college to move home.
Right.
Which I didn't have to do. I'm very, very lucky that I didn't have to do that. But it's incredible the sacrifices young people are making.
Donna, I have to say that Rachel's experience and some of the other listeners who have called and tweeted in being quite young and in this is something I really didn't anticipate in this discussion. Is it something that you researched as you were writing the book or learned about?
Yes, there is a lot of research. Now, there's an explosion of research in young adult caregivers and identifying them as a particular group with specific needs that are different from men's needs as caregivers. And I think we need to recognize that different demographic groups within caregivers need different sorts of supports. And young adults is a group that is being recognized sort of suddenly now. I pay a lot of attention to the work of Dr. Phelan Lewis. She is a researcher in the UK, but she is American from Tennessee. And she's, I think, the number one researcher today in this group that we're talking about right now of young adult caregivers and looking at how to support them in the best possible way, which is often looks very different from the types of support that we offer older adults who are giving maybe spousal caregiving or looking after aging parents.
All right. To the phones to Deborah in St. Paul. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, I'm kind of on the other end of the spectrum. I'm 70.
Uh-huh.
My mother is still alive at 101. My dad died at 98.
Boy, you have longevity in your family, don't you?
I do.
Wow.
I hope I don't live that long. But my situation is I've been their advocate caregiver, long-distance caregiver, for about 20 years. And I'm single.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any other income. And during this time of being their advocate, I worked part-time so I could be there for them. So that really affected my income.
I've been retired
5 years.
Wow.
So that's another, and I don't have anybody to advocate for me. So I have to figure all those things out.
Well, Deborah, this is a really good question that I'd kind of made a note of for the end of the show, and now you've brought it up. Kathy, what do you do if you don't have a large family support or you live somewhere and the rest of your family lives somewhere else? How do you prepare for that?
You're in a very tough situation, and it's really hard. And I empathize with you. And I guess one of the things that we probably would talk with people about here is that it might be important if you're not already involved with a church or some other kind of social organization where you might meet some other people who could be in a capacity to be your advocate as you age or to help you with some of those things. I always think that as older people, it's important to find some younger people in our lives who may be generous enough to be able to support us. It's really tough. Part of the reason that our caregiver center exists here is so for that exact reason, to provide ongoing kinds of support to people who may be the only child or may be in a situation where financial resources are not prolific. So we would attempt to connect you with community resources. I would suggest that one of the places that you might want to reach out to is your area agency on aging, because they have some options counselors that might be of help to you in terms of helping you be an advocate for yourself to find an advocate, if that makes sense. So at least they would be able to understand your situation and I think connect you with the community resources that would be in your area.
Good, Kathy. That's really helpful advice. Elise says, and this is something I hadn't thought about. I'm really glad she tweeted. I recently became an adult foster care subcontractor. I would love to be able to be a relief person for other caregivers. Are there organizations for me to do that? Donna, do you know anything about people that are doing that kind of work?
You know, it's so interesting that Elise wrote in with that. It just is so optimistic. It makes us feel, it gives us a lot of hope that this model is beginning. It's much more solidified in the UK, where organizations set up models nationwide for matching adult people who provide foster care for adults and often adults with disabilities who are looking for a family setting as opposed to institutional. But people are taking in what we call orphan seniors to look after them in their homes as well. Also, people who are seniors who may have an extra room in their house and who may need a little bit of help but are not, you know, at a point where they're looking at long-term care or anything, but they will offer free room and board to a university student. And those friendships blossom. And so these are innovative solutions to isolation and to the need for care that are excellent, I think, authentic workarounds and give us options rather than just looking at services that may
exist. Good.
I'm not aware of any organizations that are doing this in an organized fashion. However, as Kathy said, if you go to your local senior center, that's an important question to ask. Is anybody doing this in my area?
Andrea, I have about a minute and a half left, but I really wanted to get you in. What's your situation?
Hi, thank you very much. I have been looking after my mom as the primary caregiver and the court-appointed conservator for the last 6 years with her struggling with Alzheimer's. I have 3 siblings, but I am the only one with children, and my children have been, you know, growing up through this process. They're now only 9 and 12, and I think the most that I struggle with, that I could use the most help with, is finding support groups for people who are really in the sandwich generation with really young kids.
Okay.
Like, I reached out to the Alzheimer's Association, and they have adult caregiver groups, you know, for adults with, you know, looking after people with Alzheimer's, but nothing for those of us who have young kids.
Okay. So, Kathy, quickly, if you could, where to turn for some good support?
I think that probably she's exhausted it if the Alzheimer's Association or area is not doing it. If she were here, I'm sorry to say, again, she could reach out to the Area Agency on Aging, even though she's younger, just to see if they know of any resources that could be in her area. If she were here, you know, we would entertain that and say, how can we get that started? Because that's what we've been doing here is figuring out what our caregiver needs that are unmet in our community and figuring out how we can get those met.
Kathy,
I'm sorry she's not here.
I know. Kathy, I really appreciate all the good advice and the practicalities of this morning. Thank you. Donna,
thank you.
Thank you so much for being part of the discussion.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.